across Wisconsin from Civic Media. This is Up North News Radio. Now, live from our Lake Wissota studio, here's the founding editor of Up North News, Pat Breitlove.
Back now on a Monday, January 29th, 2024. Nice to have you along for Up North News Radio. We're Brittany Merlot. Civic Media meteorologist joins us now to tell us about the temperatures that just aren't moving. In fact, the 7 a.m. temps are exactly the same as the 6 a.m. temps. They range from 27 in Waukesha to 28 in Wausau, 29 in Hayward, 30 on Lake Wissota, 31 in La Crosse. Everybody's somewhere in that band, Brittany, and we feel like we're just kind of in a rut here.
I know. Hit repeat. Repeat. Mm-hmm. Repeat. Right. That's what we're dealing with right now. Temperatures statewide are slightly below freezing. That means some of that fog you're seeing out there could be freezing to some cold surfaces. So some slippery spots are possible, but we've been battling that for the past few days now as it is. Thankfully, today should be it. The winds are going to pick up this afternoon. It's going to get a little breezy out there, and the fog should clear, and we should be done with it. And that's good news because, boy, has it been dreary out there. Good news is a little bit of sunshine this afternoon is possible and still some mild temperatures. In fact, Eau Claire could hit 45 degrees today, the rest of the state hitting in the upper 30s to low 40s. And with the sunshine, it'll feel like spring break in January, basically. Wow. We do have a chance of a light wintry mix pushing in overnight. We've got a front moving through. It'll bring some light sprinkles, some spotty showers tonight. And then as our temperatures drop below freezing or right to that freezing mark, we could see it flip to a few flurries by tomorrow morning. There could be some slick spots, but this is very minor light accumulation. So just keep in mind, it might take you a little bit longer for tomorrow morning's commute, but otherwise mild and sunny all week long. We could break records as we push into February 1st for parts of the state as well. Those are going to be the warmest days, Wednesday and Thursday. But the snow, it's gone. We lost half of it, basically. I know that areas like Green Bay, they had 13 inches of snowpack going into last week. Now they have just 2 inches.
It's crazy just how unusual things have been here. We've got a note from Rob up in Tigerton telling us it's a cloudy 29 degrees. Look for fog in the area. And then he sent a PS. Need some sunshine.
So amen, brother.
Gonna have to hang on a little bit longer to get it there. But we appreciate it. Brittany Merlot, Civic Media meteorologist. Thank you so much. Have a wonderful start to your Monday.
You too. Have a great day.
All right. On the Up North News Daily newsletter, it comes out every morning about 5 a.m. or so. Christina Laurie puts that together for us. And coming up in today's newsletter, 20 uniquely Wisconsin festivals to put on your 2024 bucket list. There's a cheese curd fest. There's a deer fest. There's a chalk fest. There's UFO days. Some uniquely Wisconsin festivals that you can check out. Also, there's a divisional dialect debate. Where do people say pop? Where do they say soda? And then there's also an article there about State Superintendent Jill Underley is talking to us here on Up North News Radio a couple weeks back to discuss the current state of education in the Badger State and book bans versus students having the freedom to read. So for all that and more, head over to our website, upnorthnewswi.com. And see what we're working on for stories there. A lot of them put up by Selena Heller, who joins us. Kristen Lyerly's here. Greg Bach is here. Dr. Lyerly, the floor is yours.
Pop or soda?
Soda or get out of my house.
Really?
Ooh, okay. Wow.
There. Goodness.
Well, it's pop over on this side of the state. So
mm-hmm. Well, it's been a pleasure, everybody, shutting this down today.
And Kristen. Up there by you?
I think so. My grandma always just used to call it Pepsi. Kind of like, you know, down in Atlanta, everything is Coke.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So we always just kind of called it Pepsi.
Mm-hmm.
We were Pepsi.
I feel like you go back, like, because you're all over the state, like Minnesota, Wisconsin, wherever you are, you acclimate, you ingratiate.
And that's why out here.
That's a nice way of saying that I'm confused.
I was saying you're respecting the culture.
Yeah, that works. That works. I've long ago I use them interchangeably now. Without even thinking, just if somebody says soda, I say soda. If it pop might fall out just as easily. We're kind of in that weird little middle ground here, where you know, where we don't say, you know, use guys like you do over on the eastern side of the state, for example.
Hey, use guys.
Use guys want to pop.
So Selena's back with us after a couple of weeks off, after slipping on an icy driveway and essentially busting your tailbone. I don't know if that's the correct medical terminology, but you know, as both my wife and as Kristen, both OBGYNs, can attest, you can break that. You can do harm to that area, not just slipping on the ice, Kristen.
Yeah, well, the way that your sacrum curves and how your coccyx at the end of it kind of curves in, it is entirely possible that during the process of childbirth, you can break your coccyx or your sacrum, and there's not a whole heck of a lot we can do, and it is very painful.
Sherry mentioned that last week or so, and I had to take a knee at that point. Mm-hmm. The prospect of, you know, breaking your tailbone in childbirth is just... Ugh.
And then you've got a new baby to take care of, and like your bottom is not normal anyway. So all of you is healing. It's just, it's horrible. I mean, for those of you who think that the pregnancy is over when the baby comes out, no, here's a prime example of how people continue to need healthcare. And Selena can tell us better than anybody. I mean, it takes a long time to get better from an injury like this.
Right. The orthopedic surgeon told me he wanted me to use a walker for the next month or so. And said, you know, there's nothing you can do about it. You just kind of have to go through the weeks of it healing and the pain. And
yeah, some things only time will do. Mm-hmm. And when you talk, you know, about the long range need for care, and you talk about, you know, new moms needing that as well, it gets back to something we mentioned last week and that I'll tease for later this hour, and that is Badger Care, you know, the Medicaid program here in Wisconsin. Again, Wisconsin, one of only four states that has not expanded Medicaid from 60 days coverage for new moms to 1 year of new coverage for new moms. And coming up at the bottom of the hour, we will be talking to a colleague from our Courier Newsroom outlet, the Cardinal and Pine, in North Carolina, where North Carolina legislators, Republicans, control the chambers there, and they recently expanded Medicaid. And it's already paying big dividends for rural North Carolinians. So we'll find out more about that. But you know, getting back to Selena and the stories that she's working for here, there was something healthcare related, big news here in the Chippewa Valley last week when HSHS, Hospital Sisters Health System, announced that it was closing two of its hospitals in Wisconsin, the one in Eau Claire, Sacred Heart, and the one here in Chippewa Falls, St. Joe's. I mean, it was just this huge bombshell of news, Selena, and you know, you went out there and got some reaction, and obviously there's a lot of people are taking this hard. It was so sudden and so so intense, you know, over 1,000 jobs.
Oh my goodness, yes. So they held a rally last Friday morning in front of Sacred Heart Hospital, and so I went there and talked to some of those people, employees and staff members who were kind of just rallying for support. At this point, there was nothing they can do because the decision was made. It was a done deal, and they were just told that was it suddenly one day last week. And Shannon Van Ness, I talked with her, one of the people there. She is an employee of Sacred Heart for 7 years and 5 years working on the OB floor. And she was very emotional and talked to me about that when she heard the news, and everybody was so just surprised and devastated. And at Sacred Heart, they deliver 823 babies they did last year. So for the community to absorb that, or the region, she kind of talks about the plight of expectant mothers at this time who are planning on delivering at Sacred Heart.
Let's hear a little of that.
And whether they have a place here, they have to find a place to do it. So I'm sure it's very scary. It's already scary, you know, that whole process is. And now to kind of find this out last minute, really, for some, is very scary.
What are the numbers coming through here in terms of births a year? Do you know?
Last year, we had 823 births. And we were only getting fuller and fuller.
823 births that now have to go someplace else. Kristen, I don't know the hospital situation up there, but I can only ask you to speculate what it would feel like if something like that happened up by you.
Well, obviously this is something that people were counting on. You know, pregnancy is scary for a lot of people, and the more things you can control, the more certainty you have, the more you can rely on your hospital and your healthcare providers, the more comfortable you feel with your situation. And to lose a hospital like this that averages 2 to 3 births a day, the impact on the community, the jobs, not just the doctors and the nurses, but everybody else, it takes literally a village to run a hospital. This has had a huge impact on the community, and it's just frankly devastating.
And Selena, you did the story just a couple of weeks back about a couple racing to get to either Eau Claire or Menominee to deliver because they're out in a rural area. And now those folks having to drive to Eau Claire have one less option out there.
Right. It was bad to begin with, and now it's even worse. There's just fewer places to go in this area's Marshfield Clinic and Mayo Clinic. But I mean, everybody's talking about, you know, it's hard to get into there for any kind of health care. I also talked with Representative Jody Emerson on Friday afternoon, too. And she talked with some of the team inside of Sacred Heart and how this was just a kind of a surprise to everybody, and how can these areas just absorb all of those people? 40,000 people without healthcare with these closings, 19 clinics from throughout the region. And it's just a devastating thing. And she was saying, you know, this just doesn't happen. A whole hospital just doesn't shut down. Maybe like one in the country in a year, and we have two. So it's just a, you can't even comprehend the impact to all the health care services, mental health, and alcohol services. They have rehab facilities and just so many things.
And it's going to be such a question mark to see, you know, whether somebody else comes in to take on some of these services, or if they all just fade away and through attrition, you know, eventually some of these services come back under a different name. So there's a lot of things we don't know yet about the healthcare picture here in the Chippewa Valley. When we come back, Selena has done a story about how the Ho-Chunk language lessons are still being taught to the next generation. We'll have that and then more about Medicaid expansion coming up at the bottom of the hour. Wherever you're listening across Wisconsin on this Monday morning, when you're here, you're up north on the Civic Media Radio Network. The Milwaukee Bucks host the Denver Nuggets at 8 o'clock tonight. You can catch that game on Civic Media stations, including Oshkosh Air Support, News from the Center in Richland Center, Lake Air in Amory, WRJN in Racine, and 98Q Country in Park Falls for the Milwaukee Bucks under new coach Doc Rivers. So we're back with Selena Heller, and we were... Of the stories that you're getting back into the groove in now, after being away for a bit, one comes out of Black River Falls, and it's a great little cultural story, again, about keeping part of a culture alive. And in this case, we're talking about the language used by the Ho-Chunk.
Right. It's really important for the Ho-Chunk tribe in Black River Falls and throughout Wisconsin. In Black River Falls, they rank 7th in the state in terms of the population of students there. And so the elders are going away quickly. And so they try to preserve the language because they say, you know, once the elders go away, the language goes away, then their culture dies. So it's important that the next generation kind of takes over and takes that responsibility. And that's a big responsibility for them, but that's what they're trying in a few different schools across the state, one being Black River Falls. They have implemented classes that provide the students the Ho-Chunk language, and it's non-Native and Native students alike that are taking the class. And so this is the teacher, Andrea McCaskey, who's talking about the students and her class.
I think offering Ho-Chunk language to these high school students is important because it will help them it will help them feel more connected to their culture and their heritage, as well as give them the tools to succeed in keeping our traditional way of life going, even after the inevitable happens where we lose a lot of our elders that were first language speakers.
I asked you before on Friday if this was something that was, you know, somehow state mandated, or how this program came to be in Black River Falls.
So it's a program with the Ho-Chunk Nation and their languages division, and they are providing the instructors to 5 school districts across the state. Baraboo, Nakusa, Toma are a few of them, where the native populations or the Ho-Chunk native populations are the most in the state. And so it's a partnership with the schools and the Ho-Chunk Nation to provide this class. And it's now in Black River, even going into the middle school, kids can start taking language classes. So it's very nice. It's a pretty neat program. And I was in the class and listening to it, to the kids speaking, and it was just interesting to hear it and just be in that environment where they're learning. And it's such an important thing to them.
It's so much more than language. It's the connection to your culture.
Mm-hmm. And some of the students say, you know, I can talk to my grandparents now, and that's and at like powwows and events like that, that's the only language spoken. So these generations aren't able to understand all of that. So then for them to now be able to listen and hear what's going on in a whole new way is pretty neat for them too.
Mm-hmm. And I think for others in the community to see that, it again, you know, maintains or broadens a community tie between the Ho-Chunk and the non-native population there. So, again, just a great story that Selena's working on. You can catch it over on our website or on our social media feeds. Take a look for that and everything that she does. While she plays While Wounded, and I thought, well, I mean, obviously, you're probably needing, you know, painkillers. Maybe what you've got is not enough. Based on a news story I'm seeing here, if we could get you to go back to the Trump White House, you could get all the painkillers you want, because the headline says apparently the Trump White House medical unit was handing pills out like Skittles. Kristen, did you see the list of all the pills that the Trump White House medical unit was passing out? I mean, it is
not just pills. No. Oh yeah, it's like ketamine and fentanyl, and like it's hardcore crazy stuff that I can't even that we use in emergency departments, but yes. I don't know how they use that in the White House. Ketamine?
I don't know.
deaden the pain.
The report, according to Esquire here, paints a scathing picture of the military-run facility with 60 medical personnel. It provided new context to systemic problems in a clinic that made headlines under its director, Ronnie Jackson, the doctor who later became the congressman, who had a habit that allegedly earned him the nickname Candyman. A Defense Department Inspector General report later corroborated some of those claims, which Jackson has denied and described as politically motivated. But I've seen the list there. Those lists don't lie. And remember how people got so worked up in the Biden White House when somebody left a little bit of cocaine in the White House lobby? I mean, that pales in comparison to what this list looks like. And I'm really surprised the larger news networks, Kristen, haven't done more with this.
Yeah, I would really like to see how this compares with the lists for other White Houses, because anything in a vacuum looks, you know, unusual or suspicious. And I mean, this is not what I would expect to see, but then again, I don't know what normal is. Mm-hmm. And Ronnie Jackson is that person who you kind of don't trust because you've heard him say things about the president that you frankly know are not true.
Oh, so, you know, picture of perfect health. He was first known by saying the president could live till 90 or something like that because he was in such good health.
Yeah, he's he's obese. We know he has health problems, and we know I seriously think that he is slipping into dementia. Just to hear him talk, the way he repeats his words, the way that he can't find the right words. So he just sounds like Ronald Reagan. I mean, I'm so reminded of Ronald Reagan in the beginning of his second term. But yeah, it would be nice to see a comparison so that you would have more objectivity, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. Yes, without a doubt. I feel like, and again, the way that these are being covered has always been a beef of mine, to the point where the New York Times had a headline yesterday, and the headline said something about, you know, the drug problem in the White House prior to the Biden administration. Like, prior to the Biden administration, you mean the Trump administration. Why can't you just say there was this drug problem at the White House during the Trump administration? We have such a weird set of standards, you know, that we're following in here in news coverage that we most definitely need to know more about. Selena, other things that you might be working on this week, or are you still just kind of getting back into the groove here?
Getting back in the groove. I'll have some videos coming up. We had some kids on, you know, I think we had them on.
Yes, I knew. I saw that you were talking to kids about something again. What was it?
Yes. So we're talking about, I think first we'll I talked to them about love and Valentine's Day. What is love to them? Aww. And then later on, I also will have that later on this part, but we talked about voting.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. Yes, it was very cute. One little boy talked about voting in New Hampshire.
New Hampshire. That was it. I'm like, what did you show us last week? Yes, voting in New Hampshire.
New Hampshire. And I just laughed and it was so cute.
Oh, you get to do all the fun things.
He kept saying like boating, and so his friend thought he was saying voting, and I said how do you vote, and then to his little friend, and the boy said, well, you steer it with the thing in the back, because he was talking about boating.
All this and more coming up from Selena next week. Coming up next, more about Medicaid expansion in rural Wisconsin. You're up north. Up North News is owned by Courier Newsroom, one of the fastest growing local news networks in the country. Up North News in Wisconsin was one of Courier Newsroom's first outlets, but we're also located in Michigan, Iowa, Nevada, Arizona, Texas, Florida, Virginia, Pennsylvania, New Hampshire, and then finally North Carolina, where the Cardinal and Pine is the Courier Newsroom outlet there. To learn all about it, go to couriernewsroom.com. You can also subscribe to newsletters with great reporting from some of our most frequent guests, including Kia Vakil, Mark Jacob, Carolyn Fiddler, and much more. But also at the Cardinal and Pine in North Carolina, we would find Dylan Roney there, and he joins us from North Carolina along with Dr. Kristen Lyerly to talk about Medicaid expansion. Specifically, the article that piqued my attention was Medicaid expansion is providing a lifeline to rural North Carolina. And so we'll get all into that with Dylan. Dylan Roney, good morning.
Hey, Pat, thank you so much for having me. I'm Dylan Roney with Cardinal and Pine.
Nice to have you here. So Medicaid expansion is something based on the Affordable Care Act. Kristen, maybe you can set that part up better. The Affordable Care Act essentially was federal money offered to states if they would expand the eligibility of Medicaid. Right, Kristen?
To put it in super simple terms, when Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act happened, part of it was that states had to expand Medicaid in order to offer a certain population access to healthcare. And many of the red states at the time chose not to do it for purely political reasons. Since that time, most states have chosen to expand Medicaid. Wisconsin still hasn't, still working on it. But North Carolina recently did, which is brilliant. And it has really changed things, even in the short term, especially for rural North Carolinians. Tell us all about it, Dylan.
Yeah, so it's been a decades-long battle in North Carolina trying to get Medicaid expansion. It's been a major priority of Governor Cooper since he got into office. And, you know, it really didn't look like it was going to happen. And especially since, you know, the legislature is the Republican majority and now a super majority. And you have some of the key players, Senator Berger, Speaker Moore. But I think in part what may have persuaded them was the extra funding that the Biden administration put on expanding Medicaid when they came into office. But it's been a real game changer in North Carolina. As of now, around 280,000 people have enrolled in the program. And of the five counties that have had the highest percentage of people enrolled, they've all been rural counties. So it's been really just life-changing for people in that area who, you know, were just going uninsured. And that can lead to a host of problems. You know, cancer diagnoses could go unchecked. And so now those people have the ability to see a physician and to make sure those things get taken care of.
And let's be clear that, you know, rural North Carolina, that those are not Democratic strongholds. This is an issue that, you know, healthcare should cut across party lines. Again, Wisconsin, one of only 10 states where, you know, partisanship is still a factor. When North Carolina Republicans did come to finally embrace expanding Medicaid, it wasn't as if they had all somehow become, you know, Obama disciples. They're still as Republican as ever, Dylan. So what changed?
Well, one of the things that people may not know about Medicaid expansion and Medicaid at the state level, the states have a lot of flexibility on how to set up their Medicaid program or Medicaid expansion program. And so, for example, North Carolina's program will look different than California's or Colorado's. And so I think that may have helped persuade them. And also, I think, like I said before, the extra funding the Biden administration gave in 2021, probably, I mean, I won't predict what they were thinking, but I think it had to play somewhat of a role in their thinking on choosing to expand.
And folks in rural areas really want these services. Folks who are Republicans, folks who are Democrats, it doesn't matter what your political affiliation is, if you even have it. I mean, we saw in Oklahoma that they put a referendum on the ballot, and that was how the people of deep red Oklahoma were able to expand Medicaid. This is remarkable. It's shocking to me that in a state like Wisconsin, where we would save money and more people would have coverage, especially in these rural areas, we haven't been able to do it. But it's thrilling that you have been able to do it, and it's already making a difference in these rural areas. What are you seeing when you're talking with people out in rural North Carolina? How is it having an impact on their lives?
Yes. And, you know, I spoke with someone for the article who is from Swain County, and they run a low barrier homeless shelter. And this county, it's one of the poorest counties in the state. I think it has the lowest life expectancy in North Carolina. And, you know, the people that they work with, people that are chronically homeless, they're eligible for Medicaid. And, you know, before this, they would have had no opportunity to enroll. We know that the difference between being insured and being uninsured is drastic. You know, people can go months without being checked for, you know, cancer diagnosis. I spoke with a doctor in Vance County who talked about, you know, patients who, you know, they would just have to skip treatment, or they would have to, you know, ration medication, things like that. And they discussed how now the expansion has taken place. They have access to these needed medications, so they're not going to go without that moving forward.
There, it was put so well by one of the doctors in your story, a physician from Henderson, who said, Medicaid is such comprehensive health insurance. It's so straightforward. The copays are clear. The formula is clear. It's just such user-friendly health insurance. Patients are able to get dental care. They're able to get transportation to specialty appointments that are in the city. Again, it's just simple. Now, one of the knocks on Medicaid is that reimbursement rates, you know, could definitely be higher, especially in some of these rural areas. But again, before we even get to that, we got to get to coming off of zero and providing this essential care to all these people in rural areas. If that's what one doctor's saying, I'm sure the patients probably agree quite readily with her.
Yeah, absolutely. Like you said, it's an imperfect remedy, but it's one of the key remedies that the states have. I know people, there's always a debate about, you know, how do we best administer health care? But at the state level, if you're a state level politician, this is really the way that you can provide health care to the people in your state that desperately need it. And right, I mean, you know, if you're a physician, you're now able to help those patients who before you may just not have been able to do anything to help them because they didn't have insurance and now they do. And so it's a lifeline for rural hospitals as well. We've had a lot of hospital closures in the last decade. There are some hospitals that are on the brink in North Carolina. This could be the lifeline they need as well.
It's something that I see when I work in rural Minnesota, which is very similar, is that many of my patients who need just routine prenatal care can't even get to the clinic because they don't have a ride. And that's another piece that Medicaid expansion offers. It helps with that transportation issue. So maybe it's not a cancer diagnosis and maybe it's not getting that medication, but it's just getting to the clinic so that you can get that preventive care so that we know that your outcomes will be better, so that down the road, your health will be better. Providing this now is truly an investment in the future health of rural Minnesotans, North Carolinians, and hopefully soon in the future, Wisconsinites as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And that transportation provision is really key because, I mean, I think a lot of people take it for granted, but there are people out there who just don't have a mode of transportation. And we're not exactly known in this country for mass transit and, you know, high speed rail, et cetera. So, you know, it provides reimbursement if you get someone to drive you there. In some cases, I think it helps with, you know, if you get a taxi, it can help with that. If you do have public transit in your town or city, it provides reimbursement for that also.
There are income requirements, obviously, and you spoke to one family that just would have missed the income requirement, literally making $100 more than what is allowed. Neither of the couple have health insurance. The job doesn't offer health insurance. And so there's still room to improve. There's still room to either grow Medicaid expansion or provide other care. Again, these are to working families that are looking for that extra access. So the work in North Carolina is far from done.
Yeah, absolutely. It has provided, you know, literally hundreds of thousands of people already, you know, with access to health care. But like you said, in that case, they just missed the requirement. Luckily, there was a local clinic that they're able to get care from. But, you know, it, like I said before, it's an imperfect remedy. But, you know, at the state level, it really has, or it really is that one option that lawmakers have to provide care to people.
Well, one option that they or at the federal level they could provide would be more of a public option. You talked to State Representative Lindsey Prather, who represents a rural area, and, you know, believes that that's a place that this could go. In Wisconsin, there have already been bills introduced by Democrats that would provide a public option. And if that's the case, then the income, you know, requirement doesn't become, you know, such a ceiling. It's something that can be overcome. Do you think, Dylan, that a public option is something that will get debated or considered, or are we too early in the game to tell?
I think it's too early for that. I think in North Carolina, you know, I think there is a potential for further action. I know Representative Prather mentioned, you know, some of the organizations at the state level that are providing support that, you know, the legislature could support. But I think as part of the public option in North Carolina, I think, you know, that could be a bit too soon.
Well, we'll take the baby steps where we can get them, because, again, you talk to somebody in Swain County, has the lowest life expectancy in the state, the lowest rate of insured, and the highest rate of people below 200% of the poverty level. So, I mean, the correlation is clear. Getting this extra healthcare coverage is beneficial on pretty much every measurable level.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Parker Chatham, he he runs a low barrier homeless shelter out there. And, you know, he personally said that he's signed up about 10 people since expansion started. But, you know, there are swing counties across North Carolina. I mean, the top five counties in the state with the highest enrollment rates are in rural areas. And, you know, and as impressive as the 280,000 that have been signed up so far, you know, they believe that up to about 600,000 people across the state could be eligible. And, you know, so there's still a lot of work to do. I know I talked about Down Home North Carolina. They are really making an effort to find those other 300,000+ people to get them enrolled. And I think that, you know, just to go back for a moment, you alluded to, you know, a public option. I think if there is a success rate of getting people enrolled over the next, you know, year to few years, you know, we could see further action potentially because the legislature could say, hey, people are signing up.
All right. Well, for more about that, you can head over to cardinalpine.com, where the Cardinal and Pine is based, and get the story, Medicaid expansion, providing a lifeline to rural North Carolina, and look at the potential for Wisconsin. Dylan Roney, thank you very much for the visit. We appreciate it so much. Learned a lot, and we'll look to get an update from you sometime soon.
Thank you so much, Pat. Great to speak with you today.
All right. And Kristen, I wanted to wrap up with you just by saying that again, from a Wisconsin standpoint, these are layups, you know, to get people covered, to expand it to from 60 days to a year for new moms, or just to get BadgerCare expanded all the way across. This is something where, you know, reaching out to your legislator to ask about this should be a no-brainer.
Hey, not even a layup. I mean, this is like just standing there and being fed the ball over and over again. It's just, it's so easy. And, you know, to me, practicing in Minnesota, I'm shocked at the number of taxi rides that the nurses provide and the consults to social work and all of the connections that they help to make mm-hmm. with folks who 50% of our population, of our pregnant population, needs these additional benefits. Yep. We can save moms and babies this way.
Thank you, Kristen. Terry Bell's up next. Tomorrow on the program, Chippewa County Farm Management Educator Jerry Clark is the 2024 recipient of the University of Wisconsin's Distinguished Teaching Award. He'll tell us about the vital work of helping farmers with crop rotation, markets, and new technologies that make Wisconsin agriculture a big player in global trade and in family farm success. So that, again, is tomorrow on Up North News Radio. Civic Media News Director Terry Bell joins us now with three things you need to know to start the week. And we're going to start, pick up where we left off. We were talking about healthcare earlier. We were talking about the hospitals and clinics closing in western Wisconsin here in the Chippewa Valley. So healthcare in Wisconsin, especially rural Wisconsin, remains an extremely important story. Terry, good morning.
Good morning, Pat. Yeah, this crisis mode, I would say, up in your neck of the woods. When we talk on Mondays, sometimes we play catch up a little bit on stories that are a few days old. But this is a story that's going to have repercussion for years to come. That's the two hospitals and the system of clinics all closing around the Chippewa Valley, not only Eau Claire and Chippewa Falls, but Altoona, Menominee, Augusta, Cornell, Rice Lake, Ladysmith being affected by this too. About 1,400 or so people are going to be thrown out of work. And my thoughts are also with many people who now are with long-term health issues that are, you know, being taken care of by these systems. You know, where do they go now? Many older people in rural Wisconsin already need help with someone else to get a ride to their health care. And those resources are frankly strained. Where do they go now? I mean, do they go to the Twin Cities? Do they go to Marshfield? Do they go to Duluth? Do they go to La Crosse? It's that's a long time in the car to get your basic needs met.
Were you working at Channel 13 in Eau Claire when Unirail closed down
the
tire factory?
The early 90s.
Getting that same kind of vibe with, you know, over 1,000 people losing their jobs.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
People hear about that with a factory and they go, they can really kind of feel, oh, 1,000 jobs at this one factory. Here it's two hospitals, one big, one small, a few clinics scattered about, but still you're talking about probably a nearly equally large hit to the economy, if not more.
Very much so. And their concern, obviously, that goes without saying, but they held a rally last Friday in Eau Claire. A lot of things they're concerned about is the job placement services. They don't feel they are going to meet their needs as advertised. It just seems to be help with, you know, finding job postings and brushing up your resume, which are great. But, you know, these people need something more solid to hang their hopes on than that.
Without a doubt. So it's going to be rather concerning here in the Chippewa Valley for some time to come. The former president is going to be back in courtrooms again, not so much for the E. Jean Carroll defamation case, but I think he's going back to the one that could end up with his businesses being taken over. But in the meantime, he's got eventually a very big check to write based on last week's court action.
Sure. So since last we talked, there was a judgment against him for $83.3 million for defaming a woman who accused him of sexual assault. Today, a civil lawsuit is scheduled to begin that accuses him and his company of defrauding plaintiffs by promoting a multi-level marketing scheme. Trump is trying to get that motion dismissed. So, you know, a lot of civil trials, a lot of criminal trials in all, and this is just the criminal trials. With everything that he is facing just this spring, he could be looking in excess of 700 years in prison if he's convicted on all of them and he gets the maximum sentence on all of them. So the former president and the Republican frontrunner for the nomination this year is looking at a lot of serious legal problems. The $83 million ruling last week is what got all the news. But it's just one little bit in a lot of developments we expect this year.
Oh, without a doubt. This only continues. And at the moment, Trump is kind of turning it into part of his campaign shtick, where he'll go from a court appearance to a rally and play the part of the victim. But, you know, these things are only going to continue to roll and probably snowball as well. It's still a long way till the Republican convention, much less election day. So, you know, don't assume anything is settled, especially in a year like this. And then on Wednesday, we'll have our regular homeroom segment where we again are going to be talking about public education in Wisconsin. And a consistent theme is going to be the number of school districts that have to go to referendum again, you know, lacking the financial support of the state legislature. It's going to be a lot coming up this spring again, Terry.
Yeah, last year, if I recall, was a record year for yes. local school referenda. And this year, 2024, is going to give last year a run for its money for sure. Already, an estimated one out of every four school districts in Wisconsin is expected to go to referendum. There was a deadline for getting ballots prepared for the spring election, and those numbers are still coming in. But already more than 50 school districts have said that they are putting at least one referendum on the ballot at some point this year. Many others are considering, and it just goes to show the need at the local level for more funding. The shared revenue overhaul last year was supposed to address much of this, but it appears that the school districts are still very much in need.
Well, by and large, because that you know, big deal, it was a big deal in the news, but it came out in many cases to something like $325 per pupil. And, you know, fixed expenses, just inflation itself, that doesn't begin to keep up with it. And so you're really going to have more people in all of these referendum battles getting into the notion of, you know, is it that the school district is spending too much? And I think you're going to see a lot of pushback. No, it's actually look at the revenue, look at the history of revenue support from the legislature. And it's really going to be something to see if the people in these school districts acknowledge that when they go vote, or if they take it out on the school district instead. You know, no two districts are alike, but you will not suffer for lack of content as you have your folks covering all these various school district races.
It's going to be a very busy year for school referenda. Absolutely.
Yep. Terry Bell, Civic Media News Director. Three things you need to know to start the week. Terry, thank you so much. Appreciate
thank
it
you,
very
Pat.
Much.
Have of course.
Great, you too. Great start to the week. Earl Ingram is coming up next on most of these Civic Media stations up in Wausau on Bull Falls Radio. You're going to be hearing Chad Holmes in Madison, Stephanie Miller, and James and Company up in Wisconsin Rapids. They are all followed by Matinair on Air with Jane Matinair and
Paul Harvey.
No, Greg Bach. That's
I knew it.
There you go. All followed by Todd Alba coming up at noon. Thanks for being a part of our festivities today on Up North News Radio. We'll be back at 6 a.m. tomorrow morning. Again, talking to Jerry Clark and Sherita Booker and Christina Laurie. Have a great day. We'll see you tomorrow.